Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and co-producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives, and this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night, and it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artist First World Radio Network. Tonight, we're broadcasting live from our studios in Thunder Bay, Canada, and Rock Hill, South Carolina. Tonight's Crime Beat show presents Gary Jenkins, director and producer of the documentary titled Gangland Wire, How the Mob Lost Las Vegas. Gangland Wire tells the story behind the famous book and hit film Casino. The film's director, Gary Jenkins, was an intelligence unit detective with the Kansas City Police Department. His fascinating documentary starts with a local mob squabble that escalates into several murders and bombings. The director was assigned to a team that gathered information about these events and the mobsters involved. This local mob war led to the investigators to place a mic in a Kansas City tavern named the Villa Capri. This little mic picked up a lot of disco music from the adjacent jukebox. However, in between songs, monitoring agents heard references to Las Vegas casino business deals. The hidden microphone led to wiretaps on other phones. Jenkins will discuss all this and more tonight. It's going to be a great interview, so stay tuned. You won't want to miss this one. At this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer and the sleuth of all sleuths, the indefatigable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. Ron's an award-winning author, documentary producer, and director. He's a teacher, too, publisher, and screenwriter. He's a two-time Fulbright scholar to Bangladesh and Indonesia and a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland TV series and a former instructor to the UCLA's Extension Journalism Program. Three of his books have been optioned for a movie. His latest completed project is the book Black Caesar, The Rise and Disappearance of Frank Matthews Kingpin. For more information, please go to Strategic Media Books. That's www.strategicmediabooks.com. Given his books, his extensive travels, and in-depth interviews, Ron Chepsik today is the leading expert on the fascinating world of crime. Also, be sure to visit his website. That's www.ronchepsik.com. That's C-H-E-P-E-S-I-U-K. And also, you can join him on Facebook and Twitter. Now, here's the guy with a big picture and his finger on the pulse of crime, Mr. Ron Chepsik.
Thank you, Willie. And here's a little bio of my co-host, Willie Hareb. Willie's a freelance writer, broadcast journalist from Thunder Bay, Canada, which happens to be my hometown. And he's assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in the international shipping business, and he's contributed to several trade publications. He's also contributed to a book called Movers and Mavericks, an anthology about influential people from the Thunder Bay area. And he just completed a book on Jimmy Hoffa called Vanished, The Life and Disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa, which will be coming out shortly. Willie.
Thanks, Ronnie, and thanks again to Strategic Media Books for helping me put that book on the shelf. I'm excited for that opportunity. Well, thanks, Ronnie. You know what? You know, there's something about this show on Halloween that makes us really excited, and this interview is going to be a great prelude to the Halloween night. But anyway, just before
we're on radio, Willie, we can't scare anybody.
We can't. Well, we can scare everybody. Listen to you. You could scare the pants off anybody, man, I tell you. Well, anyway, Ron, just before we reach into our mailbag and read some mail we received, I'd like to thank all our listeners around the world for tuning into Crime Beat. We're thrilled and delighted to announce we had overwhelming positive comments and thumbs up about our program. We're averaging over 200,000 listeners every week now from over 120 countries around the globe, and that's certainly something to cheer about. I'd like to thank all our production people at Artist First World Radio Network, in particular Corey Scott, Kyle, and Tony, for making this show a success and possible. Also, a special thank you to the Ryan Brothers for allowing us to use their great music for our theme song. It's got the Beat the Crime written all over it. Like I said many times, Ronnie Boy, Internet radio is the place to be. It's great to be recognized, and I guess it proves we're on the cutting edge of Internet radio. Well, Ronnie, here is this week's mailbag. Ron, this one is from Susan of New Orleans, Louisiana. Susan writes, I think Gerald Posner is full of crap. Since the murder of JFK, there has been more than credible evidence that a conspiracy snuffed out the life of Kennedy. To believe that Lee Harvey Oswald was the only one responsible is totally irresponsible. Wow, strong one there. Now, this one, Ronnie, is from Blake of New York City. Blake writes, to believe that Oswald was a one-man show who murdered Kennedy for his own glory is hogwash. The author tries to dispel the notion of any conspiracies, but it doesn't hold any water. It was the CIA, the mob, and LBJ who made it happen. Hey, Ronnie, pretty strong opinions from...
Vitriol, right? I mean, I mean...
You gotta like their opinions, man.
Yeah, well, case closed. They were referring to Gerald Posner, who was on for a great show last week about his book, where he says that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone killer of that. Yeah, some people are never going to believe that there was just one killer of Kennedy. And, you know, there's good reason, too. I mean, you know, there's a lot of questions. And even Gerald admitted that last week. But they mentioned the CIA. We're going to have Patrick Nolan. He's got a book on that. LBJ, Roger Stone next week. This program is the best coverage of the 50th anniversary of JFK assassination. We've got over, what, 5-6 shows on all aspects of it.
It's going to coverage, Ronnie. You know, 50 years after that despicable act in Dallas. Right. 50th anniversary. That's quite the milestone.
Right.
Well, also, Ronnie, there's another letter here I wanted to cite. It's from Marlon Joseph. It appears to be a friend of yours. Marlon Joseph writes, Ron, my bro, loving the show. You have interesting guests. Keep up the good work. Do you follow soccer? I'm a big Chelsea fan. Chelsea fan, Ron, come on. Hey.
Well, Marlon's a regular listener from England. He's an English gentleman, and he friended me on Facebook. So he writes pep talks. You know, he sends little email Facebook messages after our shows. Yeah. I mean, I like soccer. I love soccer. I'm looking for the World Cup next year. I'm a big Arsenal fan. When I was living in Indonesia, they got a big following there, English soccer, and I started to follow Arsenal. So I'm a big Arsenal fan.
Well, thanks to Marlon for acknowledging you, Ronnie.
And if Marlon's listening, take care, bro.
Yeah, way to go. I'm a big soccer fan, too. Don't let stir you wrong. Well, Ronnie, as you know, you've been working hard. Just before we get onto that shtick, tell our listeners out there what our next show is.
Well, we're going to have, as I mentioned, Roger Stone, the man who killed Kennedy, the case against LBJ. And Gerald Posner was on last week. He called Roger Stone a provocateur. And I've seen him on YouTube. This guy is really lively, so it's going to be a really lively show next week.
Yeah, looking forward to that. That's going to be part of the Kennedy series for us.
Right.
Well, Ronnie, again, you've been hard to get a hold of. I've been trying to get a hold of you all day, yesterday, today. I can't reach you. Your phone is busy. What the hell you been up to?
Well, a lot of things. I mean, you know, we're working on getting your book out soon, and a couple other books by other authors for our publishing company. But I'm working on that screenplay I told you, the martial arts screenplay. I was contracted. I'm co-writing it with somebody. We're trying to get it done by the end of November, and we're about halfway through, and they're hoping to start shooting the film early next year. It's going to be shot in Georgia. It's a martial arts film, and it's a lot of fun, a lot of fun.
I hear you might have a bit part in that.
Yeah, I might. One of the people associated with the film asked me, and I was kind of taken aback, you know. But who knows? I want to kill somebody, you know.
Yeah.
You know, because we get a lot of violence. It's a martial arts film, and a lot of action.
Take one look at you.
We got mafia. Yeah, we got mafia in there, and we got, you know, it's gonna be a lot of fun, and so we'll see what happens. But,
well, congratulations. On a serious note, congratulations on that, Ronnie. You deserve all those.
Okay.
Opportunities. Well, Ronnie, as you know, the Beat the Crime never stops. It never stops. Just to get you in the mood, we present our rap sheet, part of the program. Our rap sheet is a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime, and crime news you might have missed. Now, here's rap sheet item number one. Dateline, October 29th. Oviedo, Florida. Florida woman sentenced to 54 years for making child pornography. Hey, Ronnie, how low can you go? Your comments on this story.
Yeah, we can't even read some of the details of this. They're so shocking. I mean, it's just amazing. This guy that was involved was actually a former Marine. He served in Afghanistan, and he was into, quote, daddy-daughter sex and all that. But I always wonder, I said, you know, these guys are going to get caught, and they're going to go to prison. And you know, hardened criminals treat people like this. And so it's, you know, they're going to get their justice in some way. But it's really a disgusting story. But there's some disgusting people in this world, Willie.
I'm telling you, it's a terrible story. We won't devote too much time on that one. Well, Ronnie, let's get on with rap sheet item number two. Dateline, October 29th, 2013, Cleveland, Ohio. Out of execution drug, Ohio will try untested combo. Hey, Ronnie, another state is looking for alternatives after running out of the execution drug, pentobarbital. Hey, Ronnie, the Grim Reaper might have to wait for some new juice. Your take on this story.
Yeah, thank you for this heartwarming story. You must have been depressed this week with choosing. Yeah, Willie gets to choose the rap sheet.
It's Halloween, man. We got to go with the Halloween.
Yeah. Now, this is a claim to fame. This guy, he evidently that's going to be executed, or they want to execute, killed his girlfriend's serial daughter, but he's going to be the first person in any state to be executed with two drug combination. And evidently, they can only get this drug from a Danish company, and the Danish company cut off American prisons. I think it's because, it didn't mention in this article, but I think it's because they oppose the death penalty. And so they're scrambling, trying to find something so they could, you know, kill this guy.
Well, you know, he killed a 3-year-old girl.
But you know, I still think you know, I'm not a bleeding heart conservative. I believe you should keep somebody in prison, and I think it's a much. I would, if I committed a crime, you know, I would be deathly afraid of spending my life in prison.
Well,
I'd rather be put out of my misery.
Yeah, they've got the death penalty there. If they've got it out there, they should have a way to do it properly, if that's the word that you want to use. And
well, most of the industrialized world doesn't have the death penalty.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Ronnie, tell our listeners out there, our writers out there of our program how they can market their books.
Yeah, you know, Crime Beat, we've got several packages now for writers, where they can talk about their book on our show here. And have banners at our website, which is visited by hundreds of thousands of people. And anybody interested out there that's a writer, that can contact us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. That's crimebeat123@yahoo.com. Willie.
That's great, Ronnie. Give a good bang for the buck for these writers. Now, before we get on to our broadcast this evening, Ronnie, this is Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we hope you enjoy our show this evening. Your hosts are Ron Chepsik and yours truly, Will Harib. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on this internet band on Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you have a question for our guest, email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We'll be glad to hear from you, and we'll try to incorporate your ideas into our future programs. Well, Ronnie, Crime Beat's featured guest this evening is Gary Jenkins, director and producer of the documentary Gangland Wire, How the Mob Lost Las Vegas. It's going to be a great show. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Gary Jenkins.
Thanks, Ron. Thanks, Willie. It's my pleasure to be here.
Congrats on your Gangland Wire documentary. I've seen it, and it's really fascinating, especially those use of wiretaps. How's it doing?
You know, we're just getting started. My first actual public, I'm going to do a premiere here in Kansas City at a local theater on February the 15th. We're doing a fundraiser the night before for the Kansas City Police Care Team, and I know we'll sell out the theater, and the care team gets to keep all the money, and then the next night we'll do that. And I've just started my internet marketing through my website, www.ganglandwire.com. I blog about my experiences, more off-the-record kind of things, and the little things that an intelligence unit detective would have done back in the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm.
I sell it on my website, and it's starting to go, and I'm getting a lot of positive feedback from people who have seen it.
Right. And are you a native of Kansas City?
Yes, I am. I actually grew up about 50 miles north. You can tell I have this kind of northwest Missouri nasal twang.
Right. Well, you know, I was in Kansas City when I did an article on Tommy Morrison, who, you know, was one of the famous sons. I was up there and I interviewed him in Kansas City. So the thing I remembered, it reminded me of Houston, those wide streets, unbelievable. You know, you walk for an hour and you only go half a block, you know.
It's a cool place. It's got all the accoutrements of a big city, but yet kind of the feel of a small town. So
right.
I like
it. One of the great things about our show is that we try to focus on not just New York and Chicago in terms of the mob, right? And that's
right.
Why your documentary is so great. And Willie was talking about it being the story behind Casino, but it's actually more than that, right?
Yeah, it's much.
Your documentary. Talk a little bit about what your documentary is about, and then we'll get into specifics.
Okay. You know, in the early 70s in 19 Kansas City, we had a kind of entrepreneur that started buying up rundown properties in an area real close to downtown, and this is, he started this gentrification of a rundown industrial area and moving artists in long before it's gotten popular in the last few years. But he started this in the early 70s, and it got immensely popular just within a couple of years, and a lot of restaurants moved in, and people started, it became more of an entertainment district and as well as art colony and boutique shops. A guy moved in named Freddie Bonadonna, whose dad was a made guy, worked for a guy named Willie Camisano, Willie the Rat. And Freddie was immensely successful in his bar and restaurant, Poor Freddie's, and he had bought up some rights to parking, and he was making a from the city. It was unused city parking lots, and he leased them for a small amount of money. And so then he was charging like $2 a car back in 1972 and 73, and that was a lot of money. I can remember pulling in there, and they want $2 to park. I said, well, what the heck?
In the 1970s, too,
I can't pay $2 to park, but they were filling them up every Friday and Saturday night.
Yeah.
So he'd make a lot of cash money, and the mob wanted a piece of that, and he wouldn't let them have it, and that started it.
Right. Was this a scam peculiar to Kansas City or the other mobs? I never really heard this, using parking as sort of a scam.
Well, I mean, for Freddie, his dad was a made guy. Freddie was a legitimate businessman, and he just had the ingenuity. I mean, he realized that they weren't using that city parking lot, and they didn't want much for it. The city didn't know what it was worth, and it was unused at night. And there was no other parking hardly. It was just it was packed out, and so he just put a guy in there to collect $2 from each car that pulled in, and people would pay it. They were happy to pay it.
And how much money was he making?
Back then he was probably making a couple grand on a weekend on a Friday and Saturday night, which was really good cash money. And that was the deal. That's why Willie, a guy called Willie the Rat was his name, who was his dad's kind of a capro regime, I think you would call him. He was kind of his dad's boss. Now, Willie was not the boss, and he was not the underboss. He was more of a lower-level kind of captain of a crew. And so he told Freddie's dad, David, he said, you know, the mafia in Kansas City, when the Italians came here in the turn of the century, and then every major city from here east, they liked it because they were in the produce business. They settled into the city market area, and I think you'll find that in most other big cities. And so they felt they had this proprietary interest in the city market area, and that's where this was. And they thought they should have a piece of this action, because it was, again, a couple grand in cash money every weekend.
Well, that's interesting.
You know, they wouldn't give it up.
Right. So there's a big Italian American community that settled in Kansas City on that. Go ahead.
It's just like in Chicago or New York or Boston, anywhere. In the turn of the century, we had Black Hand Mafia and Italian American or Italian from Sicily and southern Italy, shopkeepers and pushcart vendors and all that, and they moved in the what we call the North End or Little Italy. And if you go down there today, it looks like an eastern city. It's all these kind of brick storefronts and apartments everything's built real close together. And so, you know, and then the Black Hand guys started preying on the Italian storekeepers, And then our boss, who was the boss during that time, Nick Savella, his dad was a victim of the Black Hand guys, and they were extorting money from him. And then Nick got into, he was like Vito Corleone. He was a young thief. And then he bucked up against these Black Hand guys, and he started robbing these protected gambling games, and then they... Big Jim Ballesteri and Tony Gizzo, wow, later boss. But, you know, it was a usual thing, and then they went after Nick, and he had to run off to Chicago, and he got protected up in Chicago. So we had this, you know, just like The Godfather, the way it developed here in Kansas City, and then Nick comes back, and he takes over, and he ends up being actually kind of his coming out in a way officially was he was caught at the Appalachian Convention in 1957. He was part of that.
Right.
So that's when we all realized, or, you know, law enforcement realized that not only there was a mafia, yeah, but there's right. one in Kansas City that's connected to all the other big cities.
Right. Yeah, well, this, Nick Savella plays a prominent role in your documentary and his family, too. Is he like the Al Capone of Chicago or Lucky Luciano of New York? Like the most famous gangster in history?
Yeah, he was. He was. And he was our boss from about 19, early 50s until he died. And right after the, when all the indictments came down in the 1980 or 81, I believe, he died just before the trials for what we called the straw man trials for the skimming from Las Vegas. Right. But he ran all that. He ran everything in Kansas City all during the 50s and 60s and 70s.
Right. Well, you know, you had this parking scam. There must have been a lot of official corruption to let something like this happen, right?
Well, you know, it's interesting. My good friend, the FBI agent that's in the movie, Bill Owsley, we've talked about that, and the city, they just didn't care. They were glad to have this little bit of extra money for that parking, and so they didn't really care. It was more of a in-between thing. Now, there are problem in corruption. We don't really have quite the same systemic corruption in the city or in the police in Kansas City as they do back east, it doesn't seem to me like, but at least nobody's ever really uncovered it. But what we had was a really incompetent liquor control with a couple of corrupt agents. And so these mob guys all wanted to build bars down here. And so liquor control... the liquor control politically appointed board, the mob, through some other politicians, said, hey, these are nice Italian boys, you need to give them a liquor license, and they're just trying to make some money. And so they, these mob guys started moving in, building bars. And as this River Key area became more and more popular, it was singles bars what was popular with what we would call yuppies. Now they were the baby boomers were in their 30s at that time, and they were all going out, and so they're building these singles bars, and they were popular. But these guys, these mob guys, they wanted to bring in strippers and go-go girls,
and it stayed Kansas City, right?
and it didn't work, but Freddie resisted them, and he had a friend on the city council who started pressuring liquor control to on the other side to not let these guys move in. Freddie was trying to keep it clean. He saw a good thing. He knew if he kept it straight and clean that everybody was going to make money. But, you know, these mob guys, if they can find a wrong way to do it, it's much more fun. I think it's more fun.
What's really interesting in your doc, you talk about how Atlantic City and Las Vegas got sort of divided up, right? You had the New York Mafia and, taking care of the Atlantic City, and you had Milwaukee, Kansas City, Chicago, Las Vegas. Talk about Kansas City's, the mob relationship to Las Vegas, and then we'll bring you into the story and talk a little bit about your background.
Okay, well, you know, Kansas City had, at the time in Cleveland, Chicago, Milwaukee, and Kansas City, each one of those mob bosses, shall we say, owned a Teamster, a high-level Teamster. It had some influence over the Central States Teamster Pension Fund.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was how you could get into a casino and then control it would be what they did. The classic is what they did with Alan Glick and the Stardust, or the Argent Corporation, which actually owned the Hacienda, the Stardust, the and now the other two are just slipped my mind, but they had actually four, but it was mainly it was the Stardust. And so Alan went, he found out if he went to one of these mob guys, he went to Frank Ballesteri in Milwaukee, who went to the mob guy, the Teamsters pension fund officer that he controlled, then he had to get Chicago, who controlled Alan Dorfman, and Milwaukee, who controlled Jackie Presser, and Kansas City, who controlled Roy Williams, who was the Teamster here in Kansas City, and got all them to agree, then they'd make the loan for Alan Glick to buy the casino. Mm-hmm. They also made some loans to Morris Schenker and Jimmy Hoffa, actually. This goes clear back to Hoffa. Made loans to Morris Schenker, and he bought the Dunes in Las Vegas. And so once you do that, you let the mob use their influence so you can get the loan, then you have to, as a casino owner, then you have to let certain people come in and work in your casino and turn a blind eye to them skimming out in order to pay them back for the loan. And so that's how, you know, here in the Midwest, that's how they really got into Las Vegas and how they were making. Well, when they took off, nobody knows how much money they really made. It was millions and millions of dollars over, 10, 15 years.
But, wow.
But when they took off the Courier, he had 2 months take, and it was $80,000. And that was just out of the Tropicana for Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Stardust was even bigger, and it was going straight to Chicago. And then Chicago was sending a piece back to Kansas City and a piece to Milwaukee and a piece to Cleveland. And we were sending a little bit to Chicago out of the Tropicana because the Tropicana was Nick Civella's own personal skimming operation that he had going outside of Chicago. So that's how we got in, and that's how it worked for year in and year out.
Yeah, Gary, I've got a one for you. It was Bugsy Siegel who started this dream, Las Vegas. Las Vegas without Bugsy would have been nothing. But, Teamsters provided the money, and I recently read that the Mormon bankers were involved. They were in cahoots with the Teamsters, and they added some legitimacy to this. You want to talk about that?
Oh, boy. that did not really...
Willie just did a book on Hoffa, so he's a little ahead of us
that sort of. Up in the straw man investigation, it was strictly the Teamsters and Alan Glick and that. So I really can't comment on.
Well, before we to take a break, is this still going on today? I mean, is this sort of level of corruption vis-a-vis Kansas City and Las Vegas?
No, that was the end of it. When they took. They convicted, of course, Nick Civella died, and they convicted his underboss, who was running the whole operation for all the Midwest, Tuffy Luna, and he's since died, and they convicted Maishi Rockman, Milton Rockman out of Cleveland, and Joey Iupa, and Joey the Clown Lombardo, and out of Chicago, and Ballesteri. When they took all those guys off, they were all the heads, and it just it was a radical shift after that, and it seemed like, listening to all those wiretaps and looking at the news accounts and then talking to the agents that were out. I went out to Las Vegas, as you know, and interviewed agents and other people who were involved at the time. It was like that was the end of it. That they made a halfway effort, but the gaming control board had changed during that time.
Wow,
the sheriff had changed, and. And it just, that was it. That was the end of it. And that's when the big corporations took over and the huge big corporations and became the Las Vegas of today, which is completely different than it was back then.
Right, and the mob doesn't have all we have is the mob museum now, right?
We got the mob museum, yeah. Now we got the, and Oscar Goodman's gone straight. I guess he was straight before, but he's now basking in his glory as a mob lawyer in the mob museum.
Right. We're going to take a break, and Corey, we're going to run the commercial, Crazy Days, and we'll be back to talk about where our listeners can get access to the documentary and learn more about our author, Gary Jenkins.
You bet. Ronnie, just before we hand it to Corey, I'm just going to do a quick station break. This is Crime Beat on the Artist First Radio Network. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on this internet band on Thursdays at 8 p.m. All our shows are archived for 24/7 listening, so if you miss one, you can check us out anytime. Now, at this time, we'll pause for a commercial break.
Hi, everybody. This is Ron Chepsik, the executive producer and host of Crime Beat Radio. We air every Thursday on the Artist First Radio Network. I would like to bring your attention to a fabulous book and a great read written by one of our favorite guests. Mickey Fawcett's Crazy Days tells the true story of London, England's East End underworld during its formative period from the late 1950s to the 1970s. Fawcett knew the infamous Cray twins intimately, and he was a part of their inner circle. He draws vivid portraits of these notorious gangsters, their lives and crimes. Fawcett was also a close confidant of the infamous Billy Hill, and he divulges tantalizing details about the gangsters, including his unconventional sex life. During the murderous East End gang wars of the 70s, the key rule of survival was kill first or be killed. This led to countless knifing, shootings, and bombings, and Fawcett was there to record it. Go to Amazon.com to buy a copy of Mickey Fawcett's Crazy Days. The book is also available on Kindle. Crazy Days is spelled K-R-A-Y-Z-Y-D-A-Y-S. We hope you enjoy Crazy Days.
And now back to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network.
Thanks, Corey. Crime Beat's featured guest this evening is Gary Jenkins, director and producer of the documentary Gangland Wire, How the Mob Lost Las Vegas. Now back to Ron.
Thank you, Willie. And Gary mentioned his website, ganglandwire.com, where he has a blog and you could find more information. There's another documentary I ran across called lifedocumentaries.com. You have an association with that. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Correct. Well, that was my I was a Kansas City policeman for 25 years, and then right. I retired and I went to law school and I started practicing law, and then I got interested in doing documentary films. I had some extra time and so I first started with, I had two films that I did. Actually, I did three. One was a work for hire. It was about the founding of a free health clinic, and it gave me some confidence. Mm-hmm. We had it put on the local public TV mm-hmm. station, and it gave me a lot of confidence. So I wanted a subject that nobody had ever touched. I didn't want to go over plowed ground as somebody done before, and I decided to do one on what slave life was like in antebellum Missouri. Because my family were slave masters back in 1840s and 1850s, I'd never read anything about what it was like in Missouri, and so I got into this, and I found all kinds of information and a couple of three experts, mm-hmm. and so I did one called Negroes to Hire, and then as an extension of that, my next one was called Freedom Seekers, the Western Stories from the Western Underground Railroad, and so mm-hmm. that tells about the Underground Railroad out here on the Western Frontier, which was completely different from Harriet Tubman and William Still back east. And so I did that one, but the story I'd wanted to tell all along was this Gangland Wire, because I lived it and I worked it. And myself and some of the agents and other officers had always talked after we saw a casino. It's like, well, wait a minute. You know, that's a soap opera. That's not really the real story.
Right. Well, Hollywood has a tendency to do that.
Yeah, I know. It sells better when you got a beautiful woman and a handsome, leading, attractive man. Now, Lefty Rosenthal was not that attractive.
that was Robert De Niro's role, right?
Right.
He played that. Well, I've done documentaries and I've done books and all. It takes a lot of work to do a documentary. How long did it take you to do the documentary, and how did you put it all together? You need financing and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Well, as you may know, when you start out in doing this thing, you're pretty much self-financed, and that's what I did and those others. And I figured out finally how to sell them at least break even. I'll never get money back for all the time I put in them, but it was kind of a labor of love. And so I wanted to tell this story, and I wanted to tell the whole story, and it's kind of an immense story that starts with this mob war in Kansas City that it put so much heat on the FBI and the Kansas City police to really go after these guys, and you know, we get the probable cause up to get this bug, and then we learned about this Las Vegas thing. And so I've been working on this for 3 years. This is it's probably the end of the third year here right now that when I finally got it done. And
you're still not through because you got to do the marketing and you got to get the word out about the documentary. But, you know, the central part of the documentary, which is really fascinating, is the wiretaps, right? And the story about how you got the wiretaps is quite interesting, because I've tried to get stuff off the feds, and it's very difficult. And the fact that you were a former police officer, did that help you? Talk about that, about how you got access to the wire. And how much were there? It was like you used so many on them, but I had the sense that there was a lot more that
there
you never used.
There is a lot more. What I did, and actually when I first, there was two ways to go on this. At first, I could tell just a local story about the River Key mob war, because everybody in Kansas City is really interested in that, and I had access to all the people, and I had, you know, some images. I didn't have any news footage at all, really, and they don't keep that stuff here. It's just they've got it in a beta format or something, and they won't go out and look for it. None of the news people kept it, and so... But I wanted to tell the whole story, and so I started asking around, and I found out that all the case files from what we call the straw man trials were still around, and all the appeals are done, and everybody is dead except one. Well, I think Tuffy he died while I was making it, but. And there's only one other guy, Pete Tamborello, who is still alive. But everybody else is dead, no appeals. And so I found out, of course I'm a lawyer now, and so I researched the law on what happens. These wiretaps were all done under Title III of the United States Code. And so under Title III of the United States Code, there is a subsection that says once all the appeals are exhausted, if any evidence placed in any evidence placed in evidence at trial is still available, then people, researchers, can go in and get that as long as it's not used to damage or embarrass anybody, and it's used for historical purposes, in which this documentary is a historical work. And so, but what you have to do is, I found out you have to file a motion with the Western District, United States Court here in the Western District in Missouri, and the U.S. Attorney's Office will look at it, and then they'll decide if they want to oppose it or not. And so consider my position, because I had worked with the U.S. Attorney's Office not only on this case, but a lot of others, because I spent a total of 13 years in intelligence, and so I worked with the U.S. Attorney's Office a lot, and there were still people down there that I knew. And the case agent on this, Bill Owsley, and his supervisor, Gary Hart, were still living here in Kansas City. And matter of fact, Bill's written two books himself. I might mention those to your audience. Mobsters in Our Midst tells about Kansas City Mafia overall from about 1960 until Bill, when Bill retired in 1970. And he touches on the straw man, but he does not go into it in the detail that I did. He also has one called Open City, which is a history of the mafia in Kansas City from the turn of the century until modern times. So Bill, and then I had a friend whose wife worked over at the FBI as a clerk, and so Bill and I talked about it, and he said, you know, he said, that stuff, I think it's all over there at the office. And so I got hold of my friend, and he got hold of his wife, and she asked around, and, you know, lo and behold, all those boxes from the straw man trials were down in the basement, including...
And they weren't damaged or anything, you know, after all these years? I mean, that's what's amazing, that they were still in condition, because you could clearly hear these characters on the
the
documentary.
They were in pristine condition. I mean, they were only used once at trial, but they were and even had a list, and each tape had a transcript with it already, which was huge. That was like I don't know if I could have done this, Ron, if I didn't already have the transcripts, because there's too many. I have a stack of transcripts about a foot high, and
so they transcribed all these.
They're already transcribed. When I got them, they're already transcribed. So I filed my motion. We get a hold of the U.S. attorney we know down there and say, "Hey, this is coming through, and here's what it's about." And he said, "Okay." And so that, you know, they're not going to pose it any unless they thought I was somebody that was going to use that to embarrass somebody or violate mm-hmm. the law in some manner. And they
that gives them an out. You know, because right. you know, if they don't want to give it to you, all they do is say, well, you're going to embarrass them now. How are you going to prove right. or not prove that you're not going to embarrass somebody? And, of
exactly.
course, some of those tapes are funny. You know, they show some of the gangsters in a poor light, you know, being
yeah.
gangsters and all that sort of stuff. So,
if you were
right, if you didn't have a law background and weren't a former a police officer, could you have got access to these tapes? You think?
Probably not. Probably, first you got to get somebody to admit they're even there. Now, eventually, these kinds of things go out to the archives. Probably mm-hmm. all these things will end up in the U.S. archives.
Right.
There's some in there now. I just went down to our local archives and found some
wow.
from another case, and they sent off back east and got the they made me the CD of the conversation. And it had a transcript with it too. So sometimes
wow.
it's even in the archives. You just have to. You just got to start asking questions and looking at all the places you can look
and be persistent.
And be persistent and find people. Do Freedom of Information Act requests
yeah.
and just keep going after them and going after them and when you can. And if this was such a local deal, it was all done here in Kansas City. I'm here in Kansas City. The case agents here in Kansas City who
mm-hmm.
worked it. I know people here at the FBI. I know people in the U.S. Attorney's Office. I'm a lawyer. You know, it just all came together for me to do that.
Right. Well, you mentioned straw men. Why was the operation called straw men?
Because it was the Alan Glick was like a straw man. I mean, he was a nothing. He was the head of this. He got the loan, but. That's all. He was just a straw man sitting there doing nothing while Lefty
right.
Rosenthal ran everything.
Right. Well, what's interesting is, you know, they really reveal a lot about how mobsters act
right.
and think and all that. And then some of the things I'll mention, and you just comment on it. One of the things they talk about is how to steal from casinos, right?
Yeah, right.
And these guys are smart. I mean, they sound like hoods, and they look like hoods. But these guys got brains, right?
Right, right. I love that comment where the, Carl Thomas is telling the story about how he was talking about snatching the money with the gaming control agent, almost looking right at him. But the guy didn't know what he was doing. He said, you know, he said, sometimes it's better if you just do it right in front of a guy. And Nick says, yeah, he said, it's better just, you know, sometimes it works much better just to do it, you know, just like you know what you're doing, just right in front of a guy.
Ronnie, I got another one for Gary here. Hey, Gary, in 1976, when Atlantic City was legalized for gambling,
right.
and curiously enough, in 1976, the Indian casino started popping up all over the country. I think there's
yeah.
over 500 now. And there's casinos popping up on the Gulf Coast all over the place. Give us your take on what the future of Las Vegas is because you can't even get a decent buffet for under $20 now.
I know it's Las Vegas is so much different, and you know it's become like Disneyland for adults. With
exactly,
they have to have. Those casinos like New York and Paris and Mandalay Bay and the Bellagio, they have to do all this extra stuff. But it's still, I mean, you go there and you can't hardly drive down the strip, and it's just bumper to bumper people now.
Right.
People seem to be going there for more than just to gamble. It used to be you just went there to gamble and maybe go to a show, and that was it. You didn't go there for anything else. And it's like whole families go there, and there's all kinds of other entertainment and just to walk around and a lot of shopping. And it's just, I don't know, it's so different than it used to be. And you can gamble anywhere. I mean, you can gamble in Kansas City. We got four or five casinos right here in Kansas City. You don't have.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? Gambling has spread, but Las Vegas is still huge.
I know.
If people want to go to Las Vegas, I was there in May for my 25th anniversary. I mean, you know, it was still an exciting place. You know, I've been there several times.
Yeah, and it got good entertainment, but the days of the cheap buffets are gone.
That's right.
Sure.
Let's take another break, Willie, and then we'll move into the last part of our show. Time's flying, as usual, when we have a great interview going.
A fascinating subject. Great interview with Gary Jenkins. This is Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on this internet band on Thursdays at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. All our shows are archived for 24/7 listening. So if you missed one, you can check us out anytime. Now at this time, we'll take a commercial break.
Hi, everybody. This is Ron Chepsik, the executive producer and host of Crime Beat Radio. We air every Thursday on the Artist First Radio Network. I would like to bring your attention to a fabulous book and a great read written by one of our favorite guests. Mickey Fawcett's Crazy Days tells the true story of London, England's East End underworld during its formative period from the late 1950s to the 1970s. Fawcett knew the infamous Cray twins intimately, and he was a part of their inner circle. He draws vivid portraits of these notorious gangsters, their lives and crimes. Fawcett was also a close confidant of the infamous Billy Hill, and he divulges tantalizing details about the gangsters, including his unconventional sex life. During the murderous East End gang wars of the 70s, the key rule of survival was kill first or be killed. This led to countless knifing, shootings, and bombings, and Fawcett was there to record it. Go to Amazon.com to buy a copy of Mickey Fawcett's Crazy Days. The book is also available on Kindle. Crazy Days is spelled K-R-A-Y-Z-Y-D-A-Y-S. We hope you enjoy Crazy Days.
And now back to Crime Beat with your hosts, Ron and Will.
Thanks, Corey. Crime Beat's featured guest this evening is Gary Jenkins, director and producer of the fascinating documentary titled Gangland Wire, How the Mob Lost Las Vegas. Now back to Gary and Ron.
Yes, and our listeners can go to ganglandwire.com to learn more about Gary and his documentary and also his career as a documentarian. Getting copies of the documentary, I know you're still in the process, it's still not on Amazon yet. Talk about how our listeners can get access to this.
No, thanks, Ron. I will. Yeah, you can use your credit card or PayPal on my website. I have a store on my website. Actually, I bought some Gangland Wire T-shirts, if you'd like a Gangland Wire T-shirt, and I wear mine everywhere, and you can order it like that off my website. I'm working on with Amazon. I didn't get the artwork right, and then I couldn't get back to it until I'll do it next week, and where they can,
right.
You can buy it on Amazon, and maybe do a digital download. I'm doing both digital download and you'll be able to rent it or digitally download it or buy it on Amazon.
Right.
Yeah, it's going to be, Gary, mention the dates that it's going to be aired in Kansas City.
Oh, in Kansas City, we're doing the premiere will be November the 15th. The public premiere will be November the 15th.
And they can get information by going to your website, right?
Right. I'll have all that on my website.
Right, on that then. Well, you know, we're talking about these wiretaps. Do you have enough for a second documentary?
You know,
maybe at a different angle.
I do. I don't know. I'll have to go back and look at them. I had a lot of stuff out of Chicago with Teamsters and really kind of stuff that I'd have to do a lot more studying on to find a couple other experts to be my talking heads besides Bill. Probably out of Chicago about the Teamsters and the intricacies of the Teamsters. Now they work. I've got Alan. They had a bug in Alan Dorfman's office, and I've got him and Joseph Lombardo talking. All kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But I need to get more background in that aspect of it. And,
right.
Tony Squatro was up there one day talking with him, and so. But you have to know, you can't just listen to a wiretap like that and think that you're going to understand what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. You have to know the context, and I may do that, but I just want to get this one done.
Well, one of the things is they talked about using codes, in their calls. A lot of times they screwed it up.
Yeah.
You know, because I've listened to some transcripts. I haven't listened to Firetask where they're trying to teach their, you know, gangsters are trying to teach their fellow gangsters how to use code. You know,
yeah.
they get all screwed up. But one of the interesting things was that you talked about, you know, handling corrupt politicians, and of course,
right,
there's plenty of them, and there's plenty of them today too. So, talk a little about that. What was their philosophy? Because they studied these guys. They knew human. These gangsters know human nature, right?
Oh yeah,
and they're really scumbags. So they know scumbags when they see them. They know how to deal with them.
Yeah,
so talk about that, about how they handled corrupt politicians. What was their philosophy about that?
Yeah, that's the thing about it. Mob guys are always looking for the weakness and where they can do something for you, and then have you then are beholden to them, and then they put that kind of psychological pressure back on you as a politician. And so, for example, there was an election in 1978, and they were donating through Carl Thomas, who was Mr. Clean at the time. Nobody, he was totally dominated by the Midwest mob, both Alan Dorfman and Lombardo and Iupa in Chicago. Mm-hmm. They knew him, and Nick Civella knew him, and he was the one back here plotting and planning. What was his statement? He told Nick, me and Don Shepard and this other guy, we just sit around my kitchen table just trying to figure out how to steal out of these casinos, because I love taking money out of the casinos. You know, when he said that, it's like, oh, my God. I mean, so he was donating money to the gubernatorial candidates, and one of them, Bob List, but and the other was Bob Rose, and so they were donating money to him, and then that's when Lefty got Bob List had been the attorney general, and he had brought this action to throw Lefty out of the casino, which is the famous scene in the casino movie when he goes off on the gaming commission, and that really did happen. So that's when Lefty's trying to come up with a blackmail plan. Well, Lefty was not as sophisticated as Nick Civella, obviously, because his plan was to get a whore to sign an affidavit, say that she had fooled around with List at the Stardust one night. And so, if you remember, Nick says, man, that shit went out with high-button shoes. he knew that wasn't going to work. It was way too unsophisticated and too much like a big blunt hammer, and it just wouldn't work. Nobody would believe it, and especially when it didn't really happen anyhow.
Did the mob still finance political campaigns like they used to? They're not as powerful as they once were.
No,
I mean, are they still messing legitimate elections up?
You know, they're not here in Kansas City. They kind of have lost. Well, you know, when they lost that steady, when they lost the Teamsters. Mm-hmm. See, as a result of all this, the Teamsters went in, the federal government moved in, the Labor Department, U.S. Department of Labor moved in on the Teamsters and put them into a trusteeship and shook all that up. And then these convictions of all these mob guys that controlled this Central States Teamsters thing. When you lose the Teamsters, see, the Teamsters, they're a huge political power because they control votes, and they control people who then union members who have a lot of money to go put into local campaigns. Because the mob, you know, a politician, a governor, a councilman, a mayor, they can't take money directly from Nick Civella.
Right.
Or from Joey Iupa. He can't,
exactly.
They can't take it from their hand, but they can take it from the Teamsters. They can take it from Carl Thomas, freaking legitimate sounding or legitimate casino, but they can't take it directly from the Teamsters. Well, when they lost the casino money and the casino legitimacy, the people they controlled in the casinos, and they lost the Teamsters, they lost all their political power. Because without the ability to give them money, you don't have any power over them.
How corrupt were the Teamsters? You know, you hear a lot of stories about
it was
corruption.
Bad.
It was really bad, right?
It was bad, yeah. It was totally bad.
Yeah, well, they set back the labor union movement, right?
Yeah,
because of their corruption. They gave, unions a bad name.
Yeah, see, like in Kansas City, Nick Civella, the mob boss, controlled this Roy Lee Williams, who was the main Teamster
I remember him.
Everybody looked up to since the 50s and the 60s, and he was totally dominated by Nick Civella. Anything Nick Civella wanted, Roy Lee Williams did, and I assume vice versa. I never did figure out what the mob did for the Teamsters. I guess they provided some muscle and could put some pressure on companies and stuff, too.
Well, we're finishing up Gary, and we really enjoyed this conversation with you. We'd love to have you back when you do your next one, and hopefully you'll be on crime on that. I just got to ask one last question. What is your favorite gangster movie?
Favorite gangster movie. Oh, man.
You're going to say The Godfather?
I can tell you what it is. I'll tell you exactly what it is,
right.
And I'll tell you why. It's Goodfellas, and I'll tell you why.
Oh, exactly. Exactly.
It's because that is the most accurate depiction of the mafia, the made guys, and how they work with the professional criminals, because that's how it works. The
right.
Professional criminals, the Irish and half Italians and Italians that are not made guys, they're the money makers. They're out there doing the crime and
the grunts of the mob scene, right?
And the mob guy then just takes a little piece of it and provides them some protection, and so that was the most accurate depiction of how it really works to me.
We're gonna have to stop it there, and with the good note that Martin Scorsese got it right.
Yes,
Goodfellas.
He did. He and Nick Pileggi got it right. In that one. More right than in the casino.
Right. Gary, thank you so much again,
and
we wish you good luck with your doc and also that premiere showing. We wish we can make it down to Kansas City, but we wish you good luck and keep us informed, okay? And maybe we'll announce the news on our show.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you then. Thank you.
Yeah.
Willie.
Thanks, Gary. Great interview.
Thank you.
Well, Ronnie, we were delighted to have Gary Jenkins on our show this evening. A great subject, like I said before, a fascinating topic. I'm going to ask you that $50,000 question. What did you learn about the broadcast today?
Well, I mean, I learned that Kansas City has a really interesting history of the mob. I mean, and it has a great connection to Las Vegas. And Gary Jenkins has really done a service for crime history by bringing this story, you know, to life with his documentary, and I recommend it to our listeners to get a copy of it to watch it. It's really interesting, Willie.
Well, I learned something here tonight. That's not only New York City, Chicago. It's Kansas City where they had a mob scene there, and I'm really looking forward to watching that documentary. You will give us a good look at how Las Vegas evolved and what happened. You know, like I mentioned in the interview, after 1976, I think the mob was finished in Las Vegas.
Right.
But in any event, it was a great interview. Well, Ron, Crime Beat brings the famous gangsta movie segment, the gangsta movie segment of the month. Ronnie, remember this one, Pulp Fiction, directed by Quentin Tarantino? How do you rate that one?
Well, you know, I'm not as big a fan of Pulp Fiction as a lot of people. I mean, it's a good movie and all that, but there are a lot of other Quentin Tarantino movies I like. The one about World War II, you know, with Brad Pitt in it, and I loved Durango and Kill Bill, of course. But it's an interesting movie. I mean, really interesting. Yeah. But it had a big influence on independent filmmaking. I mean, it really changed a lot of things.
It did. It's got a cult following, and every time I get a chance to look at it or watch it, I learn something every
day. Yeah, and you dress like John Travolta, right?
How did you know that? It's Halloween. I dress like John Travolta.
Well, they did the characters in there with perpetual Halloween in Pulp Fiction. Samuel Jackson, come on.
Anyway, happy Halloween, Ronnie. Now, just a reminder for all your listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for November the 7th. When Crime Beat brings you Roger Stone, co-author of The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ. Wherever you are tonight, we'd like to thank all of you out there for listening to our broadcast this evening. In the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com, and please spread the word about our show. And until next week, on behalf of Ronnie Chepsick and myself, Will Harib, we hope you tune into Crime Beat next Thursday, same time, at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Have a pleasant evening, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Sleep tight, Willie.